The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Carlson against Green. Geller, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case arose after respondent's son, Joseph Jones, died in a prison hospital in Terre Haute, Indiana. A year later, respondent brought suit as administratrix of Jones's estate and as Jones's next of kin, alleging that her son's death was the result of grossly inadequate and inappropriate medical treatment, in violation of the Eighth Amendment prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment and the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. Respondent named as defendants the Director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, the Warden of the Terre Haute Penitentiary, the Assistant Surgeon General, the Chief Medical Officer of the Terre Haute Prison Hospital.
Mr. Geller, perhaps as just as an ex-Midwesterner, it bothers me, it's pronounced Terre Haute.
Terre Haute. Well, I don't think I intended to say it again, but thank you. Also named were a doctor's aide.
Now you're mad.
A doctor's aide and a hospital guard at the Terre Haute Hospital. All defendants were sued in their individual as well as their official capacities. Respondent asked for $1.5 million in compensatory damages and $500,000 in punitive damages. The District Court in the Southern District of Indiana held that respondent had sufficiently alleged a cause of action for damages directly under the Eighth Amendment under the theory of this Court's decisions in Bivens and Estelle against Gamble, but it dismissed the complaint on jurisdictional grounds. The Court held that under the particular facts of this case, Indiana law limited respondent's recovery on account of her son's death to the reasonable hospital, medical, and burial expenses and expenses of administration. The Court held that it was therefore apparent that respondent could not satisfy the $10,000 jurisdictional amount requirement for federal question jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1331. The Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit reversed. The Court of Appeals agreed with the district judge that respondent had stated a Bivens-type cause of action for damages directly under the Eighth Amendment, but it refused to apply the Indiana survival and wrongful death provisions to this case. The Court of Appeals stated that, and I quote, whenever the relevant state survival statute would abate a Bivens-type action brought against defendants whose conduct results in death, the federal common law allows survival of the action. I should add at this point, although I hope to come back to it later, that while it's true that by applying the Indiana survival statutes, respondents' claims would abate, that's because of the federal jurisdictional amount in controversy requirement and not because of any provisions of the Indiana statutes themselves. Now, the petition in this case presents two independent questions. The first is whether it's proper for the courts to imply a Bivens-type cause of action directly under the Eighth Amendment in instances where an existing federal statute, here the Federal Tort Claims Act, provides an adequate federal damages remedy. The second question, which need only be reached if the court disagrees with petitioner's first point and holds that an Eighth Amendment cause of action exists, is whether the Court of Appeals correctly concluded that the survival of Respondent Fivens' action is governed by federal common law rather than by the state statutes that apply to analogous cases. I'd like to turn first to the question of implying a constitutional cause of action for damages directly under the Eighth Amendment Cruel and Unusual Punishment Clause in the circumstances of this case.
Just before you do that, do you question federal jurisdiction?
Well, if the district court is correct, and we believe that it is, then the $10,000 amount in controversy requirement has not been met. There is jurisdiction if that's been, if
well,
the $10,000.
I understand. I'm asking whether the government is questioning federal jurisdiction.
Well, we are questioning not questioning federal jurisdiction in the Bell versus Hood sense, but we are saying that.
Are you arguing there's no jurisdictional?
We're arguing that there's no jurisdiction in the federal court because the respondent cannot, recovery cannot reach the $10,000 minimum.
But do you then have to argue, or do you, that punitive damages are not recoverable?
Punitive damages are not recoverable under the Indiana statute.
But then does the jurisdictional issue turn on the Indiana statute?
If we think it does turn upon whether
you
look
at... Why don't you argue that first, then?
Well, we don't think you have to... I'd be happy to argue first.
You don't have to reach the jurisdictional issue if we...
You don't have...
I'm just trying to think it through myself, frankly, whether we, under our normal practice, we would first decide jurisdiction and then decide cause of action, I suppose. You're arguing cause of action first, I take it.
That's correct.
And is your second argument a jurisdictional argument, is, I guess, what I'm really asking you.
I think it could be phrased in that way because if
well,
federal
I know it
law
could be phrased that way, but do you phrase it that way?
Well, we have not phrased it that way, but I think it could be phrased that way in the sense that if state survival law rather than the federal common law survival remedy applies, then there is no federal jurisdiction. But that is in some ways just a peculiarity of this case, and I didn't want to make the case turn on it. We've argued it on the question of whether state or federal survival law should apply to Bivens type actions. But that is an issue that the court need not reach unless there is a Bivens-type action in this case, because if the action should proceed under the Tort Claims Act,
I understand that,
then there is federal jurisdiction.
But under your presentation, we assume for purposes of reaching the cause of action question that there is federal jurisdiction. Then if we disagree with you on cause of action, we then secondly decide whether we had jurisdiction to decide the first issue.
Only in the sense that you, if you decide on the second issue that state law applies, then the case drops out because the $10,000 limit, jurisdictional amount and controversy limit has not been satisfied. The case could then proceed, however, in state court if the court were to decide on the first issue that there is a Bivens cause of action rather than a Federal Tort Claims Act remedy.
Is it settled law that punitive damages may not be included in computing the $10,000 jurisdictional amount?
If law allows punitive damages to be recovered, then they may be included in determining whether the $10,000 limit has been reached if the complaint states a claim that could fairly lead to the recovery of punitive damages. However, in this case, if Indiana law governs on the question of survival, it's clear that punitive damages can't be recovered because it's not an element of the damages that the statute allows.
Yes, but it's a if it's a federal tort claims action, are punitive damages allowed?
No, not under the Federal Tort Claims Act.
In any event, there's it's not allowed.
That's, well, except that if you proceed under the Tort Claims Act, Mr. Justice White, you're not proceeding under Section 1331 for jurisdiction, and you don't have to meet the $10,000 amount in controversy requirement. You're proceeding under 1346.
But nevertheless, you would be arguing that that punitive damages, the availability of punitive damages, doesn't militate against implying a cause of action.
Well, that's correct. That's correct. We don't think you can get punitive damages. It's clear you can't get punitive damages under the Tort Claims Act. And under the facts of this particular case, you can't get punitive damages under the Bivens cause of action because that depends upon the peculiarities of Indiana survival law. But
well, I don't know that your brother would agree with you on that.
Well, perhaps not. But
I would suppose he would say that a Bivens cause of action is not limited by the Indiana.
Well, that his argument is that a Bivens cause of action, the survival of a Bivens cause of action is not limited by state law. But if you reject that notion and say it is governed by the state law in this case, I don't think there's any dispute that the Indiana statutes don't allow.
Not if you accept your argument. Not if you're right. If you're right.
No, only if you accept the argument that state rather than federal law applies. If you accept that argument, then I don't think there's any dispute between the parties that Indiana law doesn't allow for punitive damages in this situation. Now, it's the petitioner's position that the court should not create constitutional damage remedies in situations where there exists a statutory remedy available to fully compensate a plaintiff for his injuries. In this case, we think there can be little doubt, and we do not take the respondent to dispute, that respondent's allegations of grossly inadequate or even deliberately indifferent medical mistreatment would state a cause of action under the Federal Tort Claims Act, and that complete compensatory relief in damages may be obtained under the federal statute. This court has already held in United States against Muniz that medical malpractice claims by federal prisoners are within the FTCA. We think that in these circumstances, the court should remit plaintiffs, such as respondent, to that existing federal statutory remedy, rather than creating a remedy themselves.
Did the government raise this point before the Seventh Circuit?
No, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, government did not. We have stated as much in footnote 9 of our brief.
Nor in the district court.
That's correct. We acknowledge that the court has a rule that it will not normally consider issues not raised below. But that's not an inflexible or absolute rule, and we have put forward certain considerations in footnote 9, which we think should lead the court in this case to confront the issue. I should also add that respondents have joined us in this suggestion. They have not asked that the court dismiss the writ as improvidently granted. And therefore, to the extent that the court's rule is based on notions of fairness to the adverse party, not having new arguments made that the adverse party has not had a chance to confront, we don't think those considerations apply here. But we acknowledge the first opportunity we had after we learned of it that this precise issue was not presented to the Seventh Circuit.
The fact that it wasn't presented wouldn't necessarily lead to the dismissal of the writ as improperly granted.
As to the first question, it might perhaps. I mean, the court has a rule that it will not normally consider issues that were not raised below. It's our position that that is a flexible rule which should not be applied in this case. Now, we did raise the second question, unquestionably, in the Seventh Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit reached the issue, and that is properly
That is presented. Properly here.
That's correct. That is correct. Now, I think that the principal difference between the respondent and the petitioners on this point is that respondent maintains that Bivens' actions for damages are a matter of, quote, constitutional compulsion, and that federal courts are automatically obliged to imply such causes of action, at least in the absence of an affirmative and unequivocal statement by Congress that it intends to make a particular statutory remedy exclusive. We believe, on the other hand, that implication of constitutional causes of action for damages are not compelled, but rather are, as Justice Powell stated last term in Davis against Passman, a matter of principal judicial discretion, and that the courts must take into account a number of considerations, including the availability of statutory relief, in determining whether to exercise that discretion. Now, the petitioner's position on this point is supported, we believe, by the very language of Bivens itself. The court's opinion in that case and Justice Harlan's concurring opinion each stressed that in the absence of a Fourth Amendment cause of action for damages, the plaintiff would have had no effective means of redressing the official wrongs he suffered. Indeed, Justice Harlan specifically mentioned that Congress had refused to waive the government's immunity from suit for torts, such as the one the plaintiff in that case had alleged. Where, however, there is, in the court's words, another equally effective remedy, the court strongly suggested in Bivens that the judiciary ought to refrain from formulating an additional cause of action.
I thought, didn't the courts refer to some explicit congressional directive?
I think the explicitness came in explicit direction that there not be a cause of action for damages. But I don't. And here there is in fact an explicit statutory remedy.
But no explicit statutory directive that it be exclusive.
No, I don't think that the court discussed explicitness in the sense of exclusivity, Mr. Justice White. I think when the question is whether a statute should be exclusive, I think the court properly must look to Congress for the answer.
Well, was not the Tort Claims Act exclusive in the sense that no such remedy was available until 1946 when the act was passed?
That's correct, and no remedy for intentional torts of the type involved in the Bivens case was available until 1974.
That is against the United States.
Against the United States.
The Bivens case was not against the United States.
No, that's true. It was against the individual officer, although that was not until 1971. But I think it's significant that every time...
Or is this case against the United States?
Excuse me? No, this case is against several offices of the United States. I think it's significant that every time since Bivens that the court has had occasion to confront the Bivens issue, in Brown against General Services Administration, in Butts against Economou, and in Davis against Passman, it has repeated the suggestion in Bivens that you needn't create or extend the constitutional right of action for damages where there's an existing statutory remedy. In fact, in Davis itself, the court stated in at least five separate places in the opinion that plaintiff had no other federal damages remedy available to her, and therefore that the Fifth Amendment should provide one. Therefore, if the Tort Claims Act is, as we believe, an adequate substitute for a Bivens claim, such as the one respondent has alleged under the Eighth Amendment, we think that this Court's prior decisions lead to the conclusion that the statutory remedy alone should be pursued. I'd like to turn then to a respondent's argument that the Tort Claims Act is not an adequate substitute for an Eighth Amendment Bivens action. Now, respondent has cataloged a number of differences between the two types of actions, but in our view, the relevant question is not whether the Tort Claims Act constitutes a remedy identical in every respect to that provided in Bivens, but rather whether the federal statute can adequately and fully compensate the victims of unlawful government conduct, such as that alleged in respondent's complaint. We think that the answer to that question is plainly yes. The court remarked in Carey against Pifus that the primary purpose of a constitutional damages action is to provide monetary compensation to a plaintiff for his injuries. As I mentioned earlier, the Tort Claims Act unquestionably covers medical malpractice actions brought by federal prisoners. And in light of the 1974 amendments, it also now covers intentional torts by law enforcement officers, such as employees of the Bureau of Prisons.
But it does also, as you told us, cover negligence actions, doesn't it?
No, it says negligent or other wrongful act or omission, I believe.
Right.
It's not limited to negligence.
No, it's not, but it does, it's broad enough to encompass, and certainly does encompass negligence.
Absolutely,
actions,
yes. That was the Mueller
case. Whether a constitutional claim under the Eighth Amendment would.
Excuse me?
Perhaps it's questionable, is it not, whether a claim under the Eighth and Fourteenth Amendments would recover negligent wrongs.
I think under Estelle versus Gamble, it's clear that mere negligence wouldn't fall under the Eighth Amendment. There has to be some allegation, as there is, I think, in this complaint, gross.
Historically,
negligence.
Hasn't the Eighth Amendment contemplated intentional, cruel, and unusual conduct?
Historically, I think that's correct, although in Estelle against Gamble, the court said it's addressed to the wanton, senseless infliction of pain, which normally one would think would be intentional. There is an allegation in one of the latter clauses of the complaint in this case of intent, but if you go down the complaint, it really states a claim essentially for gross negligence. The complaint is reprinted in the appendix at essentially pages 10 and 11. There are allegations of not giving proper medication, inadequate staffing of the hospital, use of a faulty respirator, use of a wrong drug,
How about page 13 of the appendix, count 4, apparently paragraph 87. I gather all the paragraphs have been reprinted. The above alleged actions of the defendants were of a malicious and intentional nature and manifest a deliberate indifference of requests for essential treatment.
That was the paragraph to which I referred a moment ago, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, saying that at the very end, in the final count, there is an allegation which incorporates all the previous allegations and essentially says in conclusory language that they were done maliciously and intentionally. But if you go through the key portions of the complaint, which are paragraphs 1 through 18, there are allegations of gross negligence, albeit of a gross nature. It seems to us clear that if the events that occurred in this case had not occurred in a prison hospital with federal doctors, but they had occurred in a private hospital with a private patient, the same exact events, there'd be no question that what would be brought is a tort suit under state negligence law, malpractice law, and there would be a fully adequate remedy available to compensate the plaintiff for his injuries. And there's no allegation here that Indiana law is in any way deficient in allowing a plaintiff to recover if he's been the victim of malpractice, such as has been alleged on pages 10 and 11 of this complaint. But respondent nonetheless points to a number of features of a Tort Claims Act suit that she claims makes the statutory remedy wholly inadequate. First, she notes that the Tort Claims Act has an administrative exhaustion procedure and that jury trials are not available. But these differences, we think, merely relate to the procedures of adjudication and not to the fairness or completeness of the compensation that may ultimately be awarded to a successful litigant. And I might add that these same restrictions involving exhaustion of remedies and the absence of a jury trial are present under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, yet the court in Brown against General Services Administration held that Title VII is an adequate substitute for a Bivens action and for other statutory remedies challenging racial discrimination under the Fifth Amendment.
But didn't the court in Brown infer an intent to make the remedy exclusive?
Yes.
An intent on part of Congress to make the remedy exclusive of other statutes. That's correct.
Well, there was no exception remedy, basically. That's
correct, but there was
you
no...
You don't argue there's any such intent here, do you? There's no such evidence of a similar congressional intent.
No, there isn't. There isn't, although we don't think that that is necessary. The cause of action, the Bivens cause of action, was not created by Congress.
My question is only directed to your reliance on the Brown case.
Well, in Brown, there was no separate discussion in the court's opinion of the Fifth Amendment claim. The court certainly did not say that the fact that Congress meant to make Title VII exclusive of other statutory remedies means that it should also be exclusive of a constitutional remedy, although there was a constitutional claim in Brown, directly a Bivens claim, directly under the Fifth Amendment.
Well, Congress may have intended to make it exclusive of a constitutional claim, and then the question might be whether or not
it could.
That intent is whether or not it could.
That's correct.
But nonetheless, it might well have intended to, and I think, as I remember, Brown, I wrote it. I think I wrote that Congress intended to do so.
Intended to make it exclusive of the other
statutory remedy.
Right, although there was
of all other statutory and constitutional claims.
The word unconstitutional does not appear, I believe, in the opinion, but the court clearly made clear in Brown that Congress did intend to make Title VII the exclusive remedy for racial discrimination in employment. There is no similar legislative history here with regard to Eighth Amendment Bivens claims, because the Tort Claims Act was, of course, passed well before this court's decision in Bivens. Similarly, the fact that the Tort Claims Act recognizes certain defenses, such as the due care defense, does not destroy the effectiveness of the remedy, because these defenses are essentially equivalent, we think, to the qualified immunity defense that would be available to a federal officer in a Bivens action. Now, finally, respondent stresses the fact that punitive damages are not available under the Tort Claims Act. But punitive damages are not a form of compensation, and as the court held last term in the Faust case, they're not an essential attribute of an effective remedial scheme. Moreover, while deterrence of official misconduct is certainly an important goal, compensatory damages serve to achieve that goal, we think, to a large extent.
Well, Mr. Keller, what do you do about that Senate committee report, or do I just misread it as recognizing in 1974 certain intentional torts? The report seems to think that this just adds another remedy rather than eliminating what might have been an existing Bivens remedy.
Right. Well, I think there are a number of things that can be said about the 74 Senate report.
Give it your best shot.
I will. First thing that can be said is that the Senate report was obviously referring to Fourth Amendment Bivens actions, which, of course, at that time were the only type of Bivens action this court had recognized. And in Bivens, the court said that tort remedies were not an effective means of dealing with Fourth Amendment violations because frequently state tort law was inconsistent with or even hostile to the interests that are protected.
So you would say at least in the, even though the Federal Tort Claims Act would give a remedy for some constitutional torts, it wouldn't necessarily preempt implying a constitutional cause of action in those cases.
Yes, I think that, first of all, the Senate report was only thinking about Fourth Amendment actions, And it's, I think it's clear that to the extent we can read anything into this one sentence in the Senate report as being congressional intent, that they did not want...
Well, it was pretty clear, whatever kinds of causes of action they were talking about,
yes,
that they would, there would be parallel remedies there.
I think the focus there was obviously on the tort claim remedy that they were establishing at the time under Section 2680H for intentional torts.
So at least Congress was recognizing that the existence, the mere existence of a tort claims remedy would not bar a Bivens-type remedy.
That's correct. However...
Well, isn't that what your argument... You're just arguing the reverse now.
No. We're arguing that you needn't look to congressional intent, that Bivens' action is a creation of this court, and that the court has to decide for itself whether there are adequate statutory remedies available. So
well, assume it was the kind of a cause of action that you say the Senate report was talking about. You say we wouldn't look to congressional intent?
I think it would be one factor, after all, in...
We could, if we wanted to, just say... Congress...
I don't think there's any question that the court could. It may not be wise, but if Congress wants to create a Bivens cause of action, it can easily do so. Now, the other thing to be said about the 1974 Senate report, Mr. Justice White, is that there's clearly the suggestion, at least on the understanding, at least on the part of the author of the report, that Bivens was a constitutionally compelled remedy, because on the same page of the Senate report on which the sentence appears that you just read, there is the statement that in Bivens the court held that the Fourth Amendment requires the availability of a damages action. Now, to the extent that Congress thought that Bivens actions were constitutionally required and that Congress couldn't abrogate them even if it wanted to, I think the statement in the Senate report is merely an attempt to avoid what might be viewed by some legislators as a possible constitutional problem if it were thought that the 2680H remedy was intended to abrogate the Bivens action. But once again, we're not dealing with a 2680H claim here. It's not a tort such as Congress allowed to be pursued under the Tort Claims Act for the first time in 1974. It's a negligence action, which has always existed under the Tort Claims Act, and there's certainly no reason to believe that Congress thought that the state laws which were incorporated in the Tort Claims Act for negligence or medical malpractice, albeit of an egregious kind, was not an adequate remedy, and that therefore that Bivens' actions would have to continue to be recognized despite the adequacy of the statutory remedy.
But I thought when Mr. Justice Rehnquist put the question to you, you conceded, as I think you must, that the complaint covers more than a negligence action.
I think there's a sentence at the very end that says that these are intentional torts, but we think in light of the 1974 amendment to the Tort Claims Act, even intentional torts by law enforcement officers, which employees of the Bureau of Prisons are, would now be covered by the Tort Claims Act. So even if this were construed to be an action for battery, for example, it would be compensable under the Tort Claims Act, and once again, we think there's no need for this court to allow a constitutionally based implied
claim. Construe the 74 amendments to include prison guards and officers.
Well, there was one case in the Southern District of New York.
These are law enforcement officers.
Yes, there's no question that employees of the Bureau of Prisons are law enforcement officers by virtue of, I think it is 18 U.S.C. 3050, and that their intentional torts can be the subject of a Tort Claims Act suit under Section 2680H. I'd like to reserve the balance.
But
of
you sue time. The you sue the government there. You don't. Suit against the individuals is barred.
Suit under 2680H is against the government. That's correct.
Mr. Deutsch.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Deutsch, and I am the attorney for the respondent in this case. The government urges before this court two related theories which would provide no remedy at all for the decedent in this case, despite the serious deprivations of the Bill of Rights that he has suffered. It's imperative that the court properly understand the claims that we brought here. We brought a claim for deliberate indifference to serious medical needs causing death. This court in Estelle v. Gamble held that claim in that language, and the district court found it, and the Court of Appeals found it, created an Eighth Amendment violation for cruel and unusual punishment. It recognized that this man, Joseph Jones, was in the custody of the government. He could not walk down the street and get medical care. He had to rely on the government to give him that medical care. And when he went out to a private hospital and the doctor there said, transfer this man to another prison because he had asthma, and the government ignored that, and when the doctor at the private hospital said, give this man medication for his asthma, and the government ignored that, and when the man predictably had a serious asthma attack, and when he went to the hospital and for 8 hours no doctor from the Bureau of Prisons came to see him, and when the respirator didn't work, even though they knew for 2 weeks that it wasn't working, and when they gave him Thorazine, which killed him in that hospital, even though Thorazine is clearly contraindicated for that kind, for asthma, we say that's cruel and unusual punishment. And what Justice Marshall said in Estelle, in the worst cases, it causes torture and lingering death. And that's what Joseph Jones suffered, and that's what we allege, and that's what the courts below found, based on the truth of the allegations in our complaint, as the court must take them to be true. And we also claim that the government deprived him of life without due process of law, a Fifth Amendment claim, clearly recognizable under the Fifth Amendment, and as well as that deprivation was caused by racial animus, another equal protection component of the Fifth Amendment. We do not allege medical malpractice. We do not allege battery. We do not allege any tort, any negligence theory. We come here and we have come to the federal court with a violation of a fundamental protection of the Bill of Rights against federal officers in a federal prison. Now I ask you, why doesn't Bivens apply to that claim? Is not the Eighth and Fifth Amendment an independent limitation on the power of the federal government? Isn't that what Bivens said? Are there any special factors counseling hesitation in this case? Has Congress explicitly said that Joe Jones should not get damages?
Suppose the federal tort claims remedy was coextensive with whatever constitutional remedy you could obtain. Would you think that would be a factor that the court should take into account in determining whether in any specific case a constitutional cause of action should be implied? It isn't a question of whether the Torts Claims Act is exclusive. It's a question of whether...
It's equally effective, Judge.
Well, it's a question of whether managing a judicially created cause of action, it should make a difference whether there's an adequate remedy elsewhere.
I agree. It's a question of whether there's an equally effective remedy for the constitutional deprivation that Jones...
Well, if there was an adequate remedy elsewhere, you wouldn't be here anyway. You wouldn't be wasting your time.
We wouldn't need to. We would have an equally effective remedy for the deprivation of constitutional rights. Why would we come here?
Let's assume the statute of limitations. Suppose you hadn't complied with the federal tort claim.
Well, I would think that would be appropriate basis for the court to say if otherwise that the statutory scheme was equally effective, that we wouldn't have anything to argue about.
So it comes down here to whether or not the differences between the remedies are sufficient that the constitutional cause of action should exist anyway.
Yeah, but it really gets to a fundamental question of what the purpose of the Tort Claims Act is and how it operates. It's not only the specific regulations in the Act, it's the whole ideology behind the Act. The Act itself makes you go to state law to fill in all the aspects of your claim. You go to state law to determine your cause of action. You go to state law to determine your damages. You go to state law to determine whether your claim survives.
So you just say the Federal Tort Claims Act could never be a decent remedy then?
I would say that it's, for a constitutional violation, it is never an equally effective remedy. No, sir.
Well, the Seventh Circuit said that many courts of appeals had, in Bivens types of actions, looked to state law for statute of limitations principles and that sort of thing. So that the Federal Tort Claims Act isn't peculiar in borrowing state law when it's necessary.
Well, you can look to state law to facilitate the policies behind the constitutional right. But if the state law is inconsistent or hostile, you don't have to apply it. In the Tort Claims Act, you have to apply it whether or not it totally wipes out your claim. In our case, if we apply the Indiana state law of survival, we have no claim.
Joe Jones is dead, but he doesn't have a claim at all. That's not facilitating the principles of the Constitution.
Well, are you saying then that the borrowing in the, from under a Bivens type of claim, say of a statute of limitations, you necessarily borrow the longest possible ones because that, quote, facilitates the claim, whereas if you borrow a shorter statute of limitations, it is, quote, hostile, close quote, to the claim?
Well, wait a minute. The statute of limitations, I would maintain, is a different question because the statute of limitations, you're supposed to bring your case. You don't bring it, and you're out. Your case is dismissed because of some kind of laches theory.
But that would be hostile to your constitutional claim.
Well, it's hostile, but the litigant could have brought the claim within a certain period of time and didn't. I'm talking about hostility when it wipes the claim out. Joe Jones could never bring a claim for survival because Indiana law wipes it out. That's hostility. Statute of limitations is not a kind of hostile state provision.
What is there that requires survival? Survival is a matter of statute, isn't it?
So I took Lord Campbell's Act to enable...
There wasn't any survival until Lord Campbell's Act, was there?
Well, yeah, but now I would suggest to the court, as the court found in Marenghi, which created a federal common law of wrongful death, that most statutes have survival.
Yes, but it's a matter of statute.
Yes, it is, Judge. But if you look to the state statute, and that statute is hostile to your right to collect deprivation of life, if the statute wipes that out, then your Fifth Amendment right is meaningless.
Well, since you and I agree that it's a matter of statute, what is there in the Constitution that guarantees survival?
There is nothing.
Why is it hostile to the Constitution not to have survival?
It's not a question of whether it's hostile to the Constitution. It's a question of whether when you're dealing with a federal constitutional right in a federal enclave against federal individuals and you look to state law and the state law is inconsistent and hostile, whether or not you apply a federal common law. That's what Judge Swiger did in the Seventh Circuit opinion. That's the question that's left open by Robertson versus Wegman, which says if the person dies as a result of a constitutional deprivation claim, you have to facilitate that right. You can't look to state law when there's no state interest involved and wipe out that right.
Mr. Deutsch, can I ask you a question about this hostile Indiana statute? As I remember it, it does two things. It says the claim survives, but it says that the only damages that can be recovered are burial expenses and hospital expenses.
No, Judge.
Isn't that right?
No. There's two statutes.
There's a wrongful death statute.
That's the wrongful death statute.
No,
there's a survival statute which says if you die as a result of the constitutional claim, it does not survive. Nobody recovers. The
state doesn't say anything about a constitutional claim.
No. No. It's a state law. It's dealing with state interest.
If you die as a result of the alleged wrong.
Right. If you die as a result of the alleged wrong. Right. In addition, there's a wrongful death statute which says that if a
Before you leave that, just a minute. What was Judge Noland? What was he? He's of course an Indiana judge. What was his rationale for his decision?
He applied both the wrongful death and the survival statute
together. And he concluded, did he not, that as a matter of Indiana law, the claim survived, but that the only damages recoverable were hospital expenses and burial expenses, and they didn't come to $10,000.
Right, because he applied the wrongful death statute.
Well, he concluded, as a matter of Indiana law, that the claim survived.
He did.
Right.
He assumed that he was bound by Indiana law. He had to apply Indiana law.
But in construing Indiana law, he found survivorship. Then he said the damages recoverable as a matter of Indiana law don't reach $10,000.
That's
now, my
right.
question to you is it not possible that you have separate questions? One, does the action survive? Secondly, if so, what damages are recoverable? And I suggest to you that possibly the first question might be a matter of state law, and the second question might be a matter of federal law.
Well, if the action does survive, and the question is one of damages, and if it does survive for Joseph Jones, and then damages is a question, as Justice White said in his dissent in Jones versus Hildebrand, a question of federal common law, and don't imply the limitations, that would be fine because you would be fashioning a remedy which would facilitate the interests of the constitutional rights that Joe Jones brings. The idea is to facilitate those interests. It's not to cut it off.
On the other hand, Judge Noland may have been wrong as a matter of federal law in saying that the you look to state law for survivorship, but write as a matter of federal law and determine the elements of damage.
Well, I
in which case you would lose.
Yeah, but I would suggest that Judge Nolan would be wrong in that, because it wipes out the claim that's brought in for the violation of the constitutional right.
You concede that Judge Nolan was correct if Indiana law applied?
No, because we didn't bring a claim for wrongful death. This is Joseph Jones's estate. The claim is for the deprivation or violation of Joseph Jones's constitutional right. Wrongful death is when the survivors bring a claim for the violation of their own rights.
Well, then you say Judge Nolan was wrong as a matter of Indiana law.
Yes, and Justice Swigert found so. He clearly found so. And Justice Swigert is a judge from Indiana. He knows the Indiana law just as well as Judge Nolan.
Better, you say.
I do.
So you... The United States says in its brief, under Indiana law, all causes of action survive.
That's false. That's absolutely false. If the court carefully reads the survival statute and the wrongful death statute and Justice Swigert's opinion, it'll be clear that there's no survival statute at all for claims where you die as a result of them.
In fact, there are two Indiana judges on the panel. Judge Grant is also from Indiana.
That's right, Judge. I want to stress this point about the Federal Torts Claim Act, because I believe...
None in the Solicitor General's office, I
guess. Probably not. The Federal Torts Claim Act contention that the government makes here is so groundless and so specious that it's important for the court to really focus on it, because it's the very same claim that Bivens made before this court and was rejected. What did Bivens say? Bivens said, the government said in Bivens, this man has a cause of action in state tort law. He should bring it there, and it should be like two private parties suing each other. The court rejected that. They said that he shouldn't be limited to state tort remedies. They say here, and in Bivens, the government conceded that every time someone sued in state court under that theory, they removed the case to federal court. So you got a case in state under state tort law being litigated in federal court. That was what the court rejected in Bivens. Here, we got a case in federal court under the Tort Claims Act. We have to apply state law on every single substantive issue and procedural issue. Justice Blackmun, in his dissenting opinion in Robertson versus Wegman, specifically said the state tort law policy is not sufficient to protect the rights of disfavored groups. The court in Monroe v. Pate, in Bivens, In Davis have consistently said state tort law is insufficient here. That's the whole purpose of the Civil Rights Act. And we're not going to say that to make stronger protections for state officials' violations of rights rather than federal officials.
Suppose we agree with you on the
with respect to the Torts Claims Act, that it isn't preclusive here. What do you do about Robertson against Wegman?
I would suggest to the court...
You just say that here it's hostile and there it wasn't?
Yeah, that's the very question that was left open in Robertson. It said, we're not talking about a specific abatement case in one case, which happens here. We're talking about general hostility, because no case survives. Specifically, what the case in Robertson versus Wegman left open is if the person dies as a result of the unconstitutional action... The court said we're not holding that claim wouldn't survive, because what about the policies of deterrence and compensation?
So what if Indiana law says no survivorship unless you leave a spouse? I suppose you wouldn't be here.
No.
Well, what about Robertson against Wakeman?
No, I would say, first of all, that are you saying a spouse to bring the action in the name in a survival case?
It's a survival case.
No, I would say that would be too restrictive and too inhospitable to facilitate. I don't even think you have to go to Indiana law.
That's what certain dissenters.
First of all, in Robertson, it was a case against state court officials. 1988 said you have to go to Indiana law. We don't have any state interests here. As I said, we have a federal defendants, we have a federal enclave, we have federal constitutional rights, and a federal prisoner.
And yet you concede that the state statute of limitations would be governing, don't you?
I don't concede it, Judge, but I can make a difference between a statute of limitations and a survival statute that precludes all claims.
Well, do you say the survivor statute would have to enable collateral relatives to bring the action?
The purpose of a survival statute...
Do you or don't you?
Yes. You bring it in the name, it's for the constitutional deprivation to the person that died. It doesn't matter who brings it.
Well, then do you say that so it would also have to permit the state of Indiana to bring it under the law of S. Cheese?
No. Well, then there's no interest if the federal government gives money and it goes to the state. That doesn't make any sense. But we're talking about the constitutional violations to Joe Jones. His estate is bringing it. The damages are measured by the damages to him, not the damages to his wife. And I would point out to the court, Joe Jones has a mother, has a father, has a sister, and has a brother. It's not like he has nobody that would take from his estate. And why shouldn't he be able to collect from his estate?
In my brother White's hypothetical case, that is an Indiana statute that says there shall be survival of an action if there is a surviving widow, and only if there is a surviving widow, would the adequacy of the state remedy depend upon whether or not there were a surviving widow?
Yes, Judge. If you would say you had to go to state law under...
No, under your submission, not what I would...
Well, I'm saying you shouldn't go to state law unless it facilitates the interest involved.
In that case, it would facilitate the interest involved.
Not if the claim abated, it wouldn't.
No, it wouldn't abate. There would be survivorship if there were a widow, and in this case, there is a widow.
No, I'm sorry, Judge. There's a mother.
In this hypothetical case, there is a widow.
Yes, there would be a widow.
So it would all depend upon whether or not there were a widow.
Right. If there were a widow and the case would not abate, then I would say the state law could facilitate the interest, yes.
But if not, then you'd have to go under a Bivens claim.
Not a Bivens claim, a federal common law of survivorship. The Bivens claim stays...
Where does this common law of survivorship come from?
It comes from the courts.
You and I agreed it was statutory, didn't we?
I'm saying if there is no state law that facilitates the interest...
At common law, there was no survivorship. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
So how can there be a common
law
of survivorship?
Well, because as the court did in Marenghi, a Supreme Court case about...
That was in Admiralty.
That's right. It looked at all the state laws.
Right. And
it said there now has become a common law of survival, and we're going to fashion a federal common
law
of survival.
Not common law, wasn't it?
Pardon?
That was not common law. It was admiralty law, wasn't it?
Yeah, but they fashioned a remedy.
As a matter of admiralty law.
Well, as a matter of federal common law, it was an admiralty case, but
it was
certainly...
there's a difference between admiralty law and common law, isn't there? I always thought...
Well, there can be common law remedies in admiralty cases, common law structures that promote the admiralty interests.
You can get admiralty and common law together. Because up to years in admiralty, you didn't have lawyers, you had proctors.
Right.
That was up until about 5 years ago. So don't you want to recognize that distinction?
Well, from the Marenghi case, several other courts of appeals have fashioned federal common law of survival in cases similar to this. They use that case as a basis. I recognize that admiralty is different. I would just say to the court, once you get beyond the fact that you're applying in the Tort Claims Act state law in every instance, state law on all the substantive issues, then you look at the Act itself. And we're talking about constitutional rights here. Why should he file a medical malpractice case when he's got an Eighth Amendment claim? They make you take that claim and put it forward as a medical malpractice case. You can't get a jury trial, and I would suggest that when you're talking about the enforcement of civil rights, it's necessary that you involve the public in that. A jury trial is afforded to a Bivens plaintiff. The immunities, there are extra immunities under the Tort Claims Act. For example, there's a discretionary immunity, which this court specifically rejected in Butts. First of all, you immunize all federal individual officers. They're immunized. Then the government, in addition, is immunized for all discretionary activities that they did. All higher-up officials are immunized under 2688. So that's an additional immunity to good faith immunity. There's no punitive damages. When we're talking about enforcing a constitutional right, compensation and deterrence, compensation and punishment are fundamental, have always been fundamental.
Mr. Deutsch, has there ever been a holding by this court that a Bivens-type action necessarily requires the allowance of punitive damages?
No, there hasn't. Carey versus Pifus, which is a 1983 case, leaves that open. But I would suggest to the court, if you're talking about a case like this, where a man in prison had no other alternative but wait for his medical care, and he never got even the most basic medical care, there has to be some deterrence. And what is the ramifications of going under the Tort Claims Act to other constitutional deprivation?
But on the deterrence rationale, you've got a lot of different defendants here. Would you suggest that punitive damages is appropriate against Norman Carlson, for example, the director of prisons?
I would. He was specifically placed there. This is the fourth prisoner at Terre Haute Federal Prison to die.
I suppose you could equally claim them from the Attorney General of the United States.
No.
He was in the custody of the Attorney General.
No. Norman Carlson was specifically called. There were letters written to him. There was a protest.
Oh, I see. It's based on specific contact.
Oh, yes. I'm not talking respondent superior on any of this.
I see.
Norman Carlson is specifically involved in the facts of this case. The doctor who did nothing is involved. I would suggest maybe there wouldn't be punitive damages for the staff man who was left in a hospital for 8 hours and no doctor came while a man died in his hands. But certainly the higher-ups, deterrence is necessary. Four prisoners died at Terre Haute Prison in a space of 8 months from grossly wanton negligence and medical care, not negligence. Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. What perfect situation is there for a deterrence? To get them to change the medical care that existed at that prison. If you tell us that we have no claim under the Constitution, where are there going to be changes? What remedy does Joe Jones have other than damages in this case?
Don't you think that there is some deterrence factor that if this were a Federal Tort Claims Act case and there were repeated gross negligence shown, that the deterrent would be the discipline and perhaps dismissal of all the people involved?
Judge, that would be good. That would be a deterrence. But the Tort Claims Act is completely silent on any disciplinary mechanism against the individual who is responsible for the action. Very interestingly...
Well, you must be aware, or perhaps you're not, that sometimes military medical men have been dismissed from the service after a federal tort claims case disclosed their negligent conduct.
That would be fine if that happened, but first of all, we wouldn't even have a claim under the Tort Claims Act in this case, because our claim would abate, because we'd have to apply state law. So there would be no deterrence in Indiana under the Tort Claims Act for anyone. Indiana, you better kill them rather than injure them, because you're better off.
Do you have a suit under Indiana law at all? Let's assume the man hadn't died. Would you have a suit?
Yeah, but under Indiana law, Indiana has an Indiana Medical Malpractice Act. So we would have to convene a board of doctors first, and we would have to present our claim to the doctors, which we would still have to do under the Tort Claims Act, because we have to apply the law of the place. And then we'd have a monetary limitation on the amount of recovery. And we're caught in the vagaries of state law, the limitations, the insufficiencies, when we're talking about fundamental Bill of Rights, the protections of the Bill of Rights, the federal victims of offenses of federal officials. Right now, Justice Berger, the government, the Executive Department of the government, since 1973, has been trying to get the Tort Claims Act to be the exclusive remedy. There's been three bills in Congress. The Congress has rejected them. In order to get it passed, the government has made substantial concessions that they're not in the Federal Tort Claims Act. They agree to give up qualified immunity, which exists now in the Tort Claims Act. They've put in a strong disciplinary schedule to punish people.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock, Counsel.